section number 1198, Rule 2.
Mr. Ian Fraser, Realtor.
She was destined and for places like the Atlantic and Russia, trips down to Gibraltar, and in fact many places which the my Lords of the Admiralty had in mind. We weren't to know everything at the time, but it was an amazing thing that how little one naval department knew about the other. You remember, recall, I mentioned the other chap was sunk 2 days later. That I did not know at the time. I found it out later. When I took off from Lowestoft, I, for some reason, this business of Devonport and Lowestoft, I was sent back to, before I could go to the Cape Argonne, I had to go back to Drake. And from Drake, I had to go back again to Europa in Lowestoft, which by the nickname for that was the Sparrow's Nest, because it was a Mr. Sparrow that owned the theatre. Anyway, I got back again, so that's another 4 days travelling on the train, two there and two back from Devonport. I took off for Belfast from Lowestoft, and I don't know where I travelled in the country. Honestly, I do not know. I know it was another 4 days till I got to Larne. Stranraer, I should say, the Larne Stranraer ferry, arrived at Larne, proceeded down to Belfast, and when I got to the dock, the Cape Argonne was on leave. So the very kindly shore people there said, well, you better have a draft ship and go and leave yourself. So back I went, all the way back to Nottingham. This took about a week from Lowestoft to back to Nottingham. And then, of course, I picked it up from there, and we were a pretty new crew. And met the captain and everybody else. And we were thoroughly welcome in Belfast by a certain section of the community. The others, we weren't welcome. In other words, one side of York Street, which was Main Street from the docks up to the county buildings, was Catholic on the right, and on the left it was Protestant. And one night I happened to wander across the road in Belfast to the right-hand side, turned down another road to the right, and a chappy came up to me and said, do you want to get killed, sonny? I said, not particularly, what's wrong? Well, he said, if you walk any further down that road, he will be, because this is the Falls Road. And he says, you will be killed as sure as hell, son, he said. And he took me back to the main York Street, and he pointed up and down. He said, on that side you can drink any way you want, but you come across here and you're in trouble. And the man was a gentleman. He knew he was non-political. He just wanted to help me out, and he took me across the road, actually, and I bought him a drink, and he disappeared again, and that was it. But you had to be careful, even in those days.
So the hostility was to you because you were in the Navy?
Yes, I think so. Could be. It's difficult to tell. English, yes. Navy, obviously, so I should think it was. Yes.
And you're obviously in uniform?
Obviously, yes. Yeah.
Did you actually come across hostility at first hand in Belfast or Northern Ireland?
The dockyard workers, as anywhere else in the world, they did tend to go a little bit more slowly, we thought, than they should have done. They were always playing cards when they should have been working, but nothing we could do about that. That was up to the Admiralty.
But nobody spoke to you in a hostile way?
No. We found the girls very friendly. The shore bases, of course, well, they were naval anyway, so there were no problem there. No, I apart from that one incident, I always had a very, very happy time in Belfast. Very, very nice people, very warm-hearted, whatever the religion. It's just these hard lines. I suppose you get them anywhere, any town, any part of the world.
What was the captain of this Cape Argona like?
What's
his background?
Well, he actually was the captain of a liner, which name escapes me at the moment, and he was R&R and volunteered for trawlers because he didn't relish the captain's table attitude on a liner, and he was a very, very senior man. He could have got a much bigger ship, but he chose our ship, and we cussed the man from the start. When we came on board, we were a pretty new crew. We were all fairly new. There was one or two had been at Dunkirk, but mainly we were all new crew. And he would, didn't matter what time of day or the night he was, tied up alongside, he'd be on the bridge with a stopwatch, kept pressing the stopwatch, and action stations sounded. And he kept us out this day after day, night after night, week after week. He said, "You're taking too long." This was mainly what he said, if he said anything at all. All he could see was this figure leaning over the bridge, everybody. And I think it took us 7 minutes to get to action stations when he started on us. And he got that down to 2.5 minutes by the time he finished with us. He called us all on deck one day and he said, "Right, that's the end of that." He said, "You've got down to my standard now, up to my standard." And he said, "There'll be no more. The next time you hear the alarm bells, they will be for real." The man was a gentleman. He told us what he'd been doing. Because we didn't really know. I mean, mealtime, just going to go ashore, anything. He'd pull this trick on us. But it saved our life later on, because it made us so efficient that we were, well, obviously, very efficient. Put it that way.
And the background of the rest of the crew?
Background of the rest of the crew, very, very mixed. Mostly hostility onlys, like myself, with the backbone of R&Rs and Royal Fleet Reserve chaps. As I say, we had a crew of 57 officers and men, five officers, the rest were the bows and down to the newest bloke that had joined. But Captain Pate, E.R. Pate, of DSO as he later became, he welded us into one, everybody worked for one another. And a very good trick he had at sea, he would have exercises. This is when we were not on when we were close inshore mostly, or if it was a quiet convoy, he would for exercise, and he would have every man change hands, change his job. I would go up onto the bridge as a signalman. Signalman would come down to the wireless office and go on the RT. Obviously, he couldn't do Morse, but he could go on the RT and work that. I found myself in the stoke hole, up the mast as a seaman, on the bridge mostly, but any job on the ship, mostly one of the communications crowd worked with the communications crowd. In other words, we had ASDIC, so I'd find myself in the ASDIC, which I was in charge of anyway. The ASDIC chap might find himself on the bridge or in my wireless cabin. And the big laugh about that, of course, when anybody else had been in your wireless cabin, they always checked to see that everything was absolutely done well right when you got back. But that was again another trick of the skipper's. If anybody got wounded or injured, then another person could take his place. Found myself on guns, all sorts of things. Very, very efficient man. And he was loved by, oh, when I say loved, He was liked by all. He would, if if anybody was inefficient, he got rid of them. There was nobody inefficient on the ship. He demanded 99%. He gave 99% himself, and that was, if you worked with him, you were all right. If the minor offences such as coming on board drunk, late, or whatever, which on a big ship would have meant quite a hefty sort of sentence, he would give them 7 days stoppage of leave and name a date, and it always turned out the date he said the stoppage of leave started from was the day we sailed to sea. So in other words, the man did no punishment at all. He couldn't very well go ashore when he was at sea, could he? And that was the type of man Captain Pate was, a gentleman, if ever there was one. And of course he was senior officer of the trawler group. And also, he thought he was handling, I think he thought he was handling a destroyer when he came alongside, all our 10 knots, probably 12 knots if we've pushed it a bit. That was our top speed. He'd come alongside full astern on this single screw. We always tied up in good time. It was amazing. Because tying up was a tricky job with one screw. Where a destroyer got two, he could manoeuvre quite easily. He only got one screw. It was a touch ahead, a touch, you know, astern. But they were all round a jolly good crew. As I say, nobody. The only people that left the ship, there were no there was nobody kicked off the ship. Those that did, they weren't fit. Seasickness was a thing. You get a chap on board, he's stick it a week, and the captain decides, no, he can't have that. It's nothing wrong with the chap. Send him to a big ship. He'll be all right there. And that was what happened. But he only lost about a dozen the time I was on him. 3.5 years, nearly.
What kind of duties did the Cape Argona take up after you got going on that?
Well, first of all, we sailed. We were based at the name of the base was Caroline. Now, it's not on my service record, it's not Caroline. That was the name of the. We were tendered to the Caroline, although it doesn't say so on my thing. The first thing we did, we would take off. We were working towards Iceland a lot, taking convoys to Iceland, across the Atlantic, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Sydney, Nova Scotia, St. John's, Newfoundland, down to Boston, then picking up another convoy, probably spending 3 weeks across there, or a month, taking convoys up the St. Lawrence. Then back again, and general duties which a larger ship couldn't have been spared for. Then back, and we, as I say, were mainly based in Belfast. And
you said it was an escort trawler. What kind of armament did it have?
Well, it was very heavily armoured for the size of a ship. We had more armament than many a destroyer. We had a 4-inch gun forward. We had twin Oerlikons. We had a single 2-pounder pom-pom. We had Brownings, Lewis's, mounted on each wings of the bridge. We had about 6 Lewis's. We could drop a pattern. We had depth charges aft on rails, 12 each side. So theoretically, we could have dropped a pattern of 24 depth charges. Of course, that never happened because you'd soon run out of depth charges like that. But talking about depth charges, it brings to mind one very interesting little story. And I was on watch at the time in the wireless office, and I heard Captain Pate say to the ASDIC operator, you've got a contact there, so-and-so. And the ASDIC operator said, no, sir, no contact. And the captain said, give me those earphones, I can hear contact. Meanwhile, he dispatched somebody to unsecure this small boat so it was ready for instant use, Bosun, I think. And he said, "You've got a contact there." And the chappie said, "Well, I can't hear one, sir." The skipper Pate said, "Well, I certainly can." He said, "Right, fire two depth charges." So went round over the spot again. And as soon as he'd fired them, and the sea had subsided, away the small boat, and there they were on the surface. There were about hundreds of pollock and cod. In other words, he wanted some fish for the ship, and that was his way of doing it. So we had fresh cod and pollock for a very, very long time. But that was the way he would do things. He was, such a gentleman. He knew what he wanted when he wanted fish, so that was how he got them. I can't see that happening on a bigger ship, actually, can you?
No,
definitely not.
How often did you run into the enemy on these convoys across the Atlantic and to Iceland?
All the time. We were shadowed by destroyers, aircraft. The thing was in a way comical, if you can call it that by that term. There was a gap in the middle of the Atlantic, which neither our aircraft from this side or the coastal air arm couldn't cover, with Sunderland flying boats, and the Canadians from the other side couldn't cover because America wasn't in the war yet anyway. Bear in mind they didn't come until Christmas 41. Anyway, this, we're talking about just 41 now. So and then they were very slow to get organised. So really, our main escorts came from Canada across this, and they have this gap in the middle, where of course all the U-boats were just lying and waiting. And that was where we had our biggest losses, because there were no. The only thing you had against them were our own submarines, which we were rather short of because they were otherwise engaged, and your own escort itself dropping depth charges. But,
so what were the losses on to the merchantmen in the convoys like?
Very, very heavy. Those are the men I admired. The Navy, if one reflects, the U-boats weren't trying to sink any escorts, not really. They were after merchantmen. That was what they were after, stopping the goods flowing both sides. There was one very interesting thing arose, and this was on. They had a D notice slapped on it for so long. I did manage to find it. I knew, and everybody knew in the Navy what was happening. This country was down to about a fortnight's food rations, and literally down. We had nothing coming in, and we were sent across. There were about five convoys from. Canada had to get through. They had two or three fast convoys and a couple of slow convoys, and there was so much vehicular traffic, shall we say, marine wise, that most of them got through. It surprised the Germans. They didn't know which what to attack and what, and the few they sunk, it didn't make a difference. And that we had about 3 months' food supplies on board. Over the whole various ships in the convoys.
How much successes against the enemy do you recollect in specific terms on these Atlantic convoys on which you served? Do you remember any specific incidents where U-boats were sunk or planes shot down?
Yes. On one trip we saw four U-boats sunk, but we didn't take any part in it because this was mostly done by the faster escorts, the destroyers. But bear in mind our speed was very slow. We used to get the slow convoys, eight knot convoys. But given the firepower, we shot down several planes, but we were never credited with any. It was always the big ship, the senior officer of the convoy, who got his ship credited. That was, we knew that. And that was one of those things. But 1939, 1940, 1941, we took very, very heavy losses, really heavy losses. And then it wasn't until we started bombing the U-boats, the pens where they were being made, that it started to seep through, and we started to sink them. They came out with their snorkel, which was advantageous for a time, but we'd also developed a better convoy system. Then the tide turned the other way, and by 1943, I think at the end of the war, they lost 95% of all crews on U-boats. That is on record, of course, elsewhere.
Did you say that on one particular convoy that you were on, four U-boats were caught?
Yes. It was very, very heavy seas, and I think they probably had were caught unawares on the surface, because you've got 50-foot waves, and the convoy spread over probably 5 miles. And a destroyer happened to, well, of course, we had ASDIG. We ourselves had a very good ASDIG. And we picked them up, reported, we got an echo off them, reported to the other ships, and they sunk them. As soon as they saw a destroyer heading towards them, they dived, and that was it. They'd got them. That again is all on record elsewhere in other places. Because you see, myself, in my position as in charge of WT on board and radar, and I didn't actually, we knew something had been sunk, but we wouldn't know what you whatever it was. We wouldn't get that. We weren't privy to that, because nobody knew it. In fact, I don't think it's only the historians after the war who were able to put it together from German records, or if they happen to see the number on the conning tower. But otherwise you wouldn't really know who you'd sunk.
Did you personally get a close view of the sinking of any of those U-boats?
Yes, there was one at night, and he'd sunk a, well, he'd set a tanker on fire, and he was silhouetted in the flames of the thing, and I think he was taking photographs. That's all I can think of. He didn't take any evasive action, like dive straight away, and the destroyer came along and rammed him. That was the end of him.
Do you remember which year this convoy would have been
in? Yes, that would be one of the SC convoys. They were named SC slow convoys, and this would be 1941, end of 41. Yes. One very, very interesting thing about the efficiency, which we were talking about how things happened. We always got an escort when we left the Canadian side, be it Newfoundland or wherever, Sydney or Halifax. We always got an escort of their coastal guard and an aircraft. Always an aircraft was the last to leave us. And this, we'd be probably 50 miles out, or what the length of his endurance, maybe 100, 120 miles out. You've got to get back, don't forget. And always he would send a signal by oldest lamp saying, "We wish you the best of luck. Your position is now so and so and so and so, and the time is so and so." And this was not only by oldest lamp, he sent it by radio as well. Well, you can imagine our horror. Every time we were leaving the shores, that there were U-boats lurking right up to the shore, and they were picking these signals up. They knew exactly where we were. And do you think they could ever stop them doing that, these guys? No way. No. They kept on doing it.
Even though a complaint was made to them?
Well, complaints were certainly made to them by the Admiralty, but they kept on doing it. Do know that for a fact.
We haven't said anything about your own work as a telegraphist on board these trawlers. What were the main problems that you had?
The main problems, I can tell you straight away in one, were the batteries. Now, we had, obviously, wet batteries. And the design was bad. The solution would slosh about in the sea, in a heavy sea. And imagine the movement of the acid, the solution inside the battery, against the plates. It just wore the damn things, the electrolyte. You'd find when you stripped off a battery to have a look inside it, because you can imagine a car battery, but larger, and you could actually take the top off and have a look inside it, give you an idea of the type of battery. And in the bottom was all the lead paste from the lead acid battery, and I was in terrible trouble once off Iceland. I was in trouble the whole time, really, because of the bad design. But what I did, I thought, well, I don't know. Red lead. If I drain off all this stuff and make a paste with the residue in the bottom of the battery, with red lead from the bows, and mix it up and let it harden, I wonder if there'll be any sort of current flow, there's plenty of I've really reconstituted the plate, and it worked until it broke down again, and I kept on doing that. I think it was a very good idea myself. I actually thought of that one myself. I, probably being in engineering, you know, sort of thought, well, what can I hold this stuff together with? And red lead seemed to me the answer, and it did work. Of course, then we had an old-fashioned charging board, or double-throw switches on a big Bakelite charging board, and your resistances were lamps inside the thing, just ordinary lamps acting as a resistance, and these got so darn hot that they set the charging board on fire, literally set it on fire. So at the back of you, you've got your batteries getting worn out, and they were outside the wireless cabin, actually. So they got a certain amount of salt water as well, although they were covered with canvas. And inside, in the wireless office, you were not only behind the bridge, but in between the bridge and the wireless office was the steam steering gear, and which was always leaking for some unknown reason. The chief couldn't keep up with the little gland leaks. So the temperature in the wireless office was of the order of about 110. That's in the Arctic. And you were stripped down to a pair of overalls,